DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. On today's programme, the French government collapses. First-hand testimony from Georgia's brutal police crackdown.
I was standing on a street and there were maybe two other people on this street and they fired this tear gas canisters directly at me, you know, like towards my face. I had to run for cover. So it's clearly being directed at the press. What we see when they make arrests is that they're punching the protesters in the face, beating them up.
And the British Parliament backs a bill to legalise assisted dying. Those stories and more coming up.
Voici le résultat du scrutin. Majorité requise pour l'adoption de la motion de censure 288.
That is the sound of a government falling. On Wednesday evening, left-wing and far-right members of the French Parliament voted through a no-confidence motion against the government of Prime Minister Michel Barnier. This means that, with just weeks to go before President Donald Trump takes up office in Washington, Europe's two most powerful economies, Germany and France, are both without stable leadership. So, how did it come to this? Our Paris correspondent, John Laurenson, was on standby with this explainer.
While his spell as the EU's Brexit negotiator went on and on and on, Michel Barnier's stint as Prime Minister has been a very brief affair. 3 months, the shortest premiership in modern French history. The collapse of the Barnier government sinks France even deeper into the political crisis that President Macron provoked this summer, when he called snap parliamentary elections following a poor performance for his party in the European Parliament polls. The result was a big electoral breakthrough for Marine Le Pen's National Rally. Thanks to an electoral pact between all the other parties, National Rally was denied a majority in Parliament. But although Macron's centrists on the one hand and the socialists and the hard left La France Insoumise on the other were happy to work together to beat Le Pen, they were not prepared to form a government together. Instead, Macron chose Barnier, a veteran of the centre-right Republican Party, to head a government with some Macron Party centrists and some members of Barnier's own party. It was tacitly accepted by all concerned, President Macron included, that because Parliament was split into three more or less equal groups, left, centre and nationalist right, his government would only be able to govern as long as it was supported by Madame Le Pen. Marine Le Pen has, for as long as anyone can remember, been trying to normalise the party founded by her father Jean-Marie, to de-diabolise it, as the French put it. She changed its name, expelled her dad, who, liking nothing more than to stir up a scandal, had become a liability. She said the right things about the Holocaust, kicked out any members caught saying anything racist, got her MPs to wear ties in the National Assembly, watered down her party's historic hostility to the European Union. With Barnier, she was, she said, ready to give her support for the good of the country. The prize was, so the thinking went, the respectability needed so that she might next time be elected president. So what happened? Why did she decide to support a no-confidence motion drafted by the hard left, which accuses Barnier, in terms insulting to the National Rally as well as to the Prime Minister, of, I quote, giving in to the vilest policies of the extreme right? Le Pen says it's because Barnier wasn't ready to concede enough in their negotiations on social security reform. But he did concede quite a lot. Perhaps the real reason could be more to do with the legal proceedings against her and the shock decision of a French judge to try to ban her from running for office. Le Pen and 24 other National Rally figures are accused of having misspent European Parliament money. Between the years of 2004 and 2016, say the prosecutors, Le Pen and her colleagues used money destined to employ Euro MP assistants to pay militants who were in fact working in France on French rather than EU-related affairs. While a French judge cleared the centrist leader François Bayrou of similar charges earlier this year, Le Pen's prosecutor is calling for 2 years in prison, a €300,000 fine, and a 5-year ban from running for elected office. If the court pronounces a guilty verdict in March, it would be all over for Le Pen's hopes to be elected president in 2027. Just like Donald Trump railing against the deep state, Marine Le Pen used to call out what she called, using the sinister English word, the establishment. She dropped this, trying to play the powers that be rather than confront them. But with the judiciary threatening to end her political career, she is lashing out once again and taking her country into unknown territory. Parliament looks more than ever incapable of producing a working government, while the Constitution says no French elections till July at the earliest, which would still be the case even if President Macron resigns, which he says he won't. Michel Barnier may now be reminiscing about the good old days. Compared with the mess French politics has got itself into, negotiating Brexit must now seem to have been simple. John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
DW News is, of course, covering events in France closely, so follow them on social media or download DW's breaking news app for the latest. It has been a big week for breaking news in Europe. That sound comes from a video, which was the first thing that I saw when I opened my web browser after recording the interview that you're about to hear in a minute. There's a good chance that the events that it depicts may even have been happening whilst the interview was still ongoing. In the video, we see armed and masked police hauling the limp body of Georgian opposition leader Nika Gouarmia by his hands and feet and bundling him into a car. Several other opposition figures were arrested that day and offices and homes were raided in an apparent attempt to suppress a wave of mass protests triggered by the governing Georgian Dream Party's decision to suspend negotiations on joining the European Union following their contested re-election in October. And that, the protests and the state's brutal reaction to them, was what I was talking to Robin Fabreau about. He's editor-in-chief of the independent news outlet OC Media, which operates out of Tbilisi.
Yeah, I would say it's quite a mix of people coming out to the streets. It's a very broad section of society because this kind of goal, this aspiration of joining the EU does enjoy, you know, almost unanimous support among the Georgian public, which is one of the reasons it's so incomprehensible that the government would announce this. It's a very grassroots movement right now. The kind of political opposition are taking a back seat here, and it's just very spontaneous. A lot of people self-organizing, a lot of people sort of coming together to help each other out, you know, handing out gas masks because of the amount of tear gas being used, bringing hot food to the protests. It's a mix of people, and the numbers are some of the biggest we've seen in Georgia's history.
And meanwhile, in the European Parliament, MPs have been holding a solidarity rally in the Parliament building in Brussels. What kind of support, other than, you know, spontaneous little actions like this, what kind of signals has Georgia been getting? Is it enough? What's the sort of the Georgian perspective on how Brussels is responding?
I mean, there are these condemnations coming in daily from different Western countries, different European countries, of the violence against protesters, the violence against journalists, actually. I think what we've seen is that the Baltic states have taken a lead in actually enacting travel bans on Georgian officials. And I think this is something people here on the streets would like to see go further from all of Europe, actually, to say these people are not welcome anymore. And even, you know, further sanctions. This is something that people would like to see. There has not been enough of a response, a proportionate response from Brussels to that level of brutality that we're seeing and sort of undermining of Georgia's democracy.
In terms of what your team has witnessed and maybe even experienced firsthand over the course of these protests, maybe you could give me a sort of a little picture of what that brutality looks like on the ground.
Sure. So, you know, to start with, you have the water cannons, which they've been adding chemical irritants to. You have the tear gas that they're using mass amounts of. But this has also been directed at journalists, including our own journalists. So you see, you know, the water cannon is firing at protesters, and there's a group of journalists to the side, clearly marked press, and it will turn and it will knock them down, destroy their equipment. We've had police arresting journalists, destroying their equipment, including our own co-director, Mariam Nicuradze. At one point, they tried to detain her. They smashed her camera. This was the second camera that has been broken. I was standing on a street, and there were maybe two other people on this street, and they fired this tear gas canisters directly at me, you know, like towards my face. I had to run for cover. So it's clearly being directed at the press. What we see when they make arrests is that they're punching the protesters in the face, beating them up. What we don't see, but we've heard reports of, is what happens to these protesters afterwards, which seems to be very systematic. They're taken away and just put in a van and beaten up. So the Public Defender of Georgia, for example, has documented that 80% of the protesters detained have injuries to their faces, on broken noses, their eye sockets, and all of them tell the same story, that they were thrown in a van and beaten up by police in a very, very systematic way.
Robin, I hope this is all right. I would like to ask a personal question. Feel free not to answer if it is too personal. But I mean, you know, here you are, editor-in-chief of an independent and comparatively small sort of news outlet covering all that's going on. And you're sending your team, you're sending people out into these conditions. What are you telling them? What's the message that you are giving them when you send them out on their assignments?
You know, in cases like this, I will not force anyone to do anything. But I don't have to, because, you know, all of us here, we believe very strongly in the importance of the press, in documenting what's going on. And it's our lives. It's what we do. It's what's important to us. It's what we believe in. So, I mean, we try our best to stay safe. We're currently fundraising for equipment, actually, not just for ourselves, but for all media across Georgia. You know, this gas mask safety equipment. I mean, what can you say? You know, this is the risk we take with this job.
Robin Fabro, editor-in-chief of OC Media. We will be linking to your live coverage of events in Georgia as they happen in our show notes. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Kate.
The web address for OC Media is oc-media.org. Now, to some elections news. That's right. I'm hijacking our Spotify quiz section of the show for a quick update on elections news. The governing centre-right party, Fianna Fáil, came top of parliamentary elections in Ireland and has a mandate to form a coalition. In Romania, the centre-left has won the parliamentary election, but all eyes are now on the runoff presidential vote on December 8th, in which a far-right pro-Russian candidate could still emerge victorious. Meanwhile, Iceland's Social Democrats have won snap parliamentary elections, which saw voters punish the incumbent. Which brings me to our quiz question. How many seats do you think that there are in the Icelandic parliament? Is it 63, 83, 103, or 123? Head on over to Spotify to take part. Oh, and congratulations to everyone who knew that Angela Merkel's nickname was Mutti or Mummy. Gentler times. Inside Europe is, of course, available on all the other usual platforms, as are various other DW offerings, including a new kid on the block. It's called Berlin Briefing and is an in-depth, behind-the-scenes deep dive into the world as seen from DW TV's Berlin studios.
7 a.m. Berlin. Olaf Scholz is getting on the plane. I'll be on board as well, and I'll brief you at Berlin Briefing.
Berlin is right in the middle of the global tensions of our time.
between East and West, autocrats and democrats. Germany's whole system is under stress. Politics is getting angry. The far right is gaining ground.
And the world around Germany is getting more dangerous.
We break it all down with experts and political players. And we decode what it means for you. From Berlin to right where you are.
It's all in our new podcast,
Berlin Briefing, on YouTube
and wherever you get your podcasts.
Some journalists get all the glamorous gigs, don't they? Anyway, slight professional jealousy aside, I do have to say that I love the new podcast and that it comes just in time for Germany's parliamentary elections, which are looming in the new year. Christmas first, though, so relax. This is Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. What if the way that you die is as important as the way that you live? It's a haunting thought, particularly for people who are either suffering from or caring for people who are suffering from an incurable disease. For many people, the idea of being condemned to live when, as far as you're concerned, your life should be over is a nightmare that they believe instinctively they shouldn't be made to suffer. Still, only a very few European countries allow euthanasia, or assisted dying, in part because of taboos around the subject, but also in part because of genuine ethical concerns about where it might lead and who might get to make the decisions. It's a highly emotional debate which has been playing out in the British Parliament recently, as well as in homes and on the streets of the UK. Finally, last week, MPs backed a bill that makes Britain the fifth country in Europe to allow euthanasia, but only under strict conditions. The bill must still pass scrutiny to become law, but polls suggest that an overwhelming number of British people are in favour. Dan Ashby has more.
I'm just walking down a classically festive British high street with the Christmas lights out and the songs on and hot dogs being sold, but it masks what's been a difficult 2 months here, because it feels like the whole country has been in debate. We've been all talking to each other about something that Brits really don't like talking about, and that's death. Should doctors be allowed to assist a suicide when a patient is in unbearable pain? It's a simple question, but with profound political, social, and personal consequences. But walk any high street in Britain and you'll find most people are in favour.
Because I don't have to suffer and my family don't have to watch me suffer. And I don't have to go to Switzerland.
And do you feel the same way? How do you feel?
Well, exactly the same. Yeah, it's difficult. I'm not saying it's an easy decision, but I wouldn't want to be a burden on my family at all. And I wouldn't want to live my life without a certain amount of quality in it. So, yeah, I think it's a great idea.
You wouldn't let a dog suffer, so you shouldn't let a human suffer.
It doesn't seem very nice for some people, so if they've got capacity and it's not taken advantage of, then it seems probably like the humane thing to do.
People with terminal illness will still take their lives. Mm-hmm. If the bill falls today, we are consigning those people to take their lives in brutal, violent ways, as they are doing at the moment.
And so last week, the country watched as Parliament finally confronted the question too. MPs were allowed a free vote, unfettered by their party's official policies. Some read out their constituent statements.
Despite this prognosis, I can honestly say I'm a happy person now. I feel lucky to have made it to 60. There is just one black cloud on the horizon for me, and that is the way I will die. I am terrified that I will suffer a long, painful death.
But others feared for the safeguards for people who can survive, like one MP's daughter.
We were told many times that she might have only 6 months to live. Mm. She lived for 27 years. Crucially, Maria was non-verbal. And I am filled with dread and fear for those other people like Maria who are non-verbal and don't have that capacity, and what might happen to others like Maria.
Normally when vote results are read out, there are raucous cheers. But when it became clear that the bill had passed its first reading, there was just a hushed silence. Out of respect, or in horror, or perhaps to mark a moment of significant change.
The no's to the left, 275. The ayes have it, the ayes have it. And look!
Hiya, Gareth?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm Dan. Nice to meet you.
Hiya, Dan.
Hiya.
Come in.
Gareth Heslop's partner has motor neurone disease and dementia. She is unable to swallow or drink water.
Our oxygen levels were just going crazy, and then we were rushed to hospital. She was in hospital for a couple of weeks. Even while she was in hospital, we nearly lost her a couple of times. And since then, we've been at our local hospice, basically. You kind of got to put it to the back of your mind that actually every time you're feeding her, she could choke, and you know what I mean? And that's, it'd be too easy to blame yourself for that, wouldn't it? And equally, obviously, we've got children at home, and it's not something you'd want them to see, is it? So they're quite,
the real health challenge. She's now at the end of her life in a hospice, but she isn't eligible for the new assisted dying because she lacks mental capacity. But watching his partner's journey, Gareth now wants the option available for himself.
If I look at Sarah now, and it's not something we ever used to have any big discussions about, because you don't, but also knowing Sarah, I don't think Sarah's particularly in favour of, assisted dying. But if you look at Sarah, know that she wouldn't like to be how she is. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like the way I see it, it's just 10% of who she was.
Are you in favour of having the option of assisted dying for yourself?
Yeah, I am. It's interesting. I always did from an early age anyway, because my philosophy is, to live and let live, we should all be able to make our own free choices. Now, it's not as simple as that.
He fears a prolonged and painful death could leave lasting damage on relatives. But the issue of being a burden is a concern for those against assisted dying too. Alistair Thompson is from the campaign group Our Duty of Care.
Well, there are many very strong arguments against assisted suicide and euthanasia. But perhaps one of the chief concerns that we have is the way that if you look at places like Oregon, Canada, Netherlands and Belgium, how vulnerable people feel pressured into ending their lives. And indeed, if you look at the stats from Oregon, more than half of those ending their life via assisted suicide, in a model very similar to the legislation being put forward in the UK, cite fear of being a burden on their families, finances or carers as a reason.
The assisted dying bill must still pass further scrutiny in Parliament to become law, though its passage looks likely. There are major questions still being fought over. Are the safeguards strong enough? Who should qualify for the right? Who pays for it? The law will, of course, not change lives, but some say something as important. It will change people's deaths. Dan Ashby, DW, in the UK.
I'd just like to add that those parliamentary debates that you heard excerpts from in Dan's report there are actually really worth looking up. They're heartfelt and sincere, sort of a glimpse of what politics can and could be. They're on YouTube, and in their way, they're actually really heartwarming. This is Inside Europe. Our feedback address for comments about that or any other item in the show is insideeurope@dw.com. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Thank you. You're listening to Inside Europe, where we're focusing in on the subject of justice. We begin in The Hague, in the Netherlands, where the president of the International Criminal Court opened its annual meeting on Monday with a stark warning.
The court has been subjected to attacks seeking to undermine its legitimacy and ability to administer justice and realize international law and fundamental rights by coercive measures, threats, pressure, and acts of sabotage.
The ICC, and with it our whole international framework for the prosecution of war crimes, is in trouble. Setting aside the sexual misconduct allegations that have been made against its chief prosecutor, the crux of the matter is this. The ICC's power depends upon the willingness of its member countries to enforce its arrest warrants, and that is what is now hanging in the balance. Last month, the court issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, his former Minister of Defence, Yoav Gallant, and a senior Hamas official, Mohammed Daif, over war crimes and crimes against humanity. Since then, the USA and Hungary have said that they do not recognise the arrest warrant for Netanyahu, and various other countries, including France, Italy and Germany, have shown themselves non-committal. Russia, for its part, has already issued its own arrest warrants for the ICC's chief prosecutor and several judges in retaliation for its 2023 arrest warrant for Russian President Vladimir Putin. Justice, in other words, may be blind, but politics isn't, and it has the ICC squarely in its sights. But what exactly is the ICC anyway? Well, here's a quick potted history.
Well, the International Criminal Court is the pinnacle of a very lopsided movement towards war crimes justice that's been going on for about 30 years. Back in the 1990s, the United Nations set up a number of temporary war crimes courts. The most famous covered Bosnia, was also in The Hague. And it did Rwanda, Sierra Leone, Cambodia, East Timor. And out of that, there was a big move to make the process permanent. They use the analogy of a fire engine. Why would you, every time there's a fire in the town, build a new fire engine? Why not just have a fire engine in a fire station that's ready to go? And that was the logic behind setting up the ICC. But at that point, the big powers in the United Nations, especially America, China, Russia, India, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Iran, they said, no, we don't want that. We don't mind occasionally opening a court for a specific war, but we don't want to have this fire engine that can look anywhere. So it looked like the idea would die, except that a lot of countries did want an ICC, and they were basically three continents. Europe wanted it because it burnished its human rights idealism, and South America and Africa wanted it because in the 90s there were a lot of new democracies all coming online, and their number one fear was that the juntas, the former dictatorships, would take control by force again and no more democracy. And they wanted the ICC as a sort of insurance policy, that if that happened, they wouldn't escape justice. So a lot of people signed up, and now we have the situation where there's 125 countries are members of this court. But the problem is that it's not what it sounds like. It's not really an international court, as most people understand it. These laws are not universal. It's not part of the United Nations. It's a club with 125 countries that are members.
That's Chris Stephen, author of The Future of War Crimes Justice, which is out now with Melville House UK. One thing you need to know about Chris, he's a former war correspondent. His desire for a functioning framework for war crimes prosecution, it's not abstract. It's personal.
Yeah, I do believe war crimes justice is worth it. And I've seen these battles and seen the horror that happens. At its best, it works really well, because not only does it jail the warlords, but it also sets up a legal framework that dissuades other warlords from doing other terrible things. And when you've witnessed atrocities on the battlefield, the idea that there'd be less atrocities, that seems very worthwhile.
Chris, in other words, is deeply invested in the idea of international war crimes justice. And at the moment, its future looks bleak.
Well, the president of the court is right that the court is facing an existential crisis, really, because the court depends on countries who are members actually arresting war crime suspects. If the countries don't arrest them, then that undermines the whole point of the court. And this is likely to get bigger because the Trump administration is almost certain to sanction any ICC country that doesn't give Israel immunity. And the Trump administration is floating the idea of decoupling from NATO, saying no military help for you unless you give Israelis immunity. So it's likely that this trickle is going to become a flood. Now, once Israel gets mass immunities, the allies of Russia, the African countries who host Wagner Russian forces, they're going to want to give it to Russia so that Putin can visit because he's been indicted. And in fact, in September, Mongolia already did it. It invited Putin. It ignored the court's order to arrest him and said, we're just not playing by these rules. So this is really the thing that actually may kill the court, that if countries decide to give all these immunities, then the only place you can actually arrest somebody would be physically if they visited the court. And the problem is that they're allowed to do it because of what is like a bug in the system. There is a piece buried away in the ICC statute, Article 98, which allows a country that is a member of the court to give immunity to any other country. So, I mean, that could actually collapse the court because these immunities could become so big that very few people would ever make an arrest. And at that point, the ICC sits on its hill with no power.
You know, listening to you there, Chris, it occurs to me that all the speculation this week, it's been about whether various countries' potential refusal to enforce or even recognise the ICC's arrest warrant for Benjamin Netanyahu, whether that could be the skittle that topples the whole structure of international war crimes justice. But actually, you seem to be saying that the case of Mongolia's invitation to Vladimir Putin is just as critical.
Yeah, the skittle that may topple the whole thing, as you say, is Mongolia. So this week, the court has to decide, well, what are we going to do? If they punish Mongolia, Mongolia can say, but you already made the exception a few years ago for South Africa. South Africa hosted Sudan's president, who was indicted for genocide. And when the court met to rule on South Africa, it decided not to punish South Africa. It said, that's fine, you can host someone who's indicted for genocide and we're not going to take action. So Mongolia will say, you have to do the same again. You can't allow South Africa off the hook and then punish us. But if they don't punish Mongolia this week, then basically it's open field. Now, every other member of the court knows it can host Netanyahu, Putin, any war crime suspect it wants. And at that point, the court's authority evaporates, because if the members won't arrest anybody, the court actually has no power.
When you sort of set up for me the history of the ICC, you sort of it was a story of international justice, but it was also a story of politics, and it was a story of continents. You identified these three continental blocks. To what extent, at this point of crisis, do those continental blocks come into play?
Well, I think these continental blocks are very important because I think that the mood has changed so much from the 1990s. Most governments no longer fear, in Africa and South America, being taken over by some military dictatorship. Now their worry is that their own actions may get them prosecuted, particularly because the court can also prosecute for aiding and abetting war crimes. So, for instance, if you're giving weapons to Israel now, you can now be prosecuted for aiding and abetting. And human rights people would say, well, good. But if you're a government, if you're a member of the ICC, you're starting to get cold feet about the whole thing. There always is this tension between governments on one hand and justice on the other. That governments like to be seen to be in favour of international justice, but when it comes down to it, they don't want to set up a court that could one day indict them.
I was wondering if you could perhaps just set out for me the consequences of failure here. I mean, if we really are looking at a moment in time where the whole international framework of war crimes justice could come tumbling down, which seems to be what you're suggesting, what does that mean?
I mean, the trouble is this court has failed over 22 years. It's not just failing now. In 22 years, it's only jailed 6 war criminals, which is ridiculous. If you compare it to the largest of the former United Nations war crimes courts that was also in The Hague, that covered Bosnia, well, that court also took about 20 years. It also cost about the same amount of money, which is about 3 billion euros. But that court jailed 91 war criminals. So you have two courts with identical missions, with identical power. One jails 6 and one jails 91. So it's not so much that the international justice is about to come crashing down. It's really that it never took off. And I think that's the real problem with the ICC, that it had so many blunders, so many mistakes, so many times when it broke its own rules, that it's become like ash in a fireplace, that this ash has accumulated so much that now it's choking the wood. And now, you know, it may be, yes, that the whole thing comes tumbling down, in which case we're into a world in which might is right.
Could it be a moment of opportunity? I mean, could this be the moment where we get an ICC that really is fit for purpose and fit for the future?
It could be, yes. The trouble is, it really doesn't matter what the ICC president says, and it doesn't matter what human rights groups and activists say. What matters is, what do the member states say? Do they want to save it? Do they want to make it work? If they want to make it work, conveniently, they have a blueprint. Because 4 years ago, there was so much scandal and problems in the court that they brought in this independent investigation by Richard Goldstone, who is like Mr. War Crimes. He's done everything in war crimes. He has an unimpeachable reputation. And he was shocked by what he found, particularly with abuse, with bullying and sexual harassment. And his report, which you can find, it's on Google, it's freely available. And he makes some pretty shocking disclosures about the way the court's being operated. And he made, I think it's something like 300 recommendations, most of which haven't been acted on. So if the countries that run the court want to save the court, a good place to start is just to phone up Mr. Goldstone and say, okay, we have your recommendations from 4 years ago. We didn't do anything then, but we'd like to do it now. And at least, I don't know if it would save the court, but at least it would give the court credibility.
Finally, Chris, for your book, you've been talking to, you know, all these sort of legal minds, human rights lawyers, people who have thought very, very deeply about the issue of justice and what it means and indeed what its future might be. When you talk to human rights lawyers at the moment, what's your sense? Is there a sense of despair, of cynicism, of determination, of idealism?
Well, I think there's a sense of despair among many human rights lawyers now, because the wheel has turned. I mean, from the 90s, when the Cold War had ended and it seemed like the world was moving forwards, it now seems to be moving back. You have wars going on all over the place, and the ICC, the International Criminal Court, hasn't been able to make any difference. At the rate it's going, most warlords will be dead before they can be tried. And so I think that they feel that there isn't really an international consensus on dealing with war crimes justice, and that there's really a lack of will among governments to do it. So certainly I think the picture's not very optimistic.
Chris Stephen there. His book, The Future of War Crimes Justice, is out with Melville House UK Publishers. Our next story in this Focus on Justice special comes to us from Italy, where the humanitarian rescue organisation Sea-Watch has filed a criminal complaint against Italy's Coast Guard, accusing it of negligence and multiple manslaughter in the case of a shipwreck that claimed 21 lives. The German NGO says that the Coast Guard rescuers knew the migrant boat was in trouble, but waited days before responding. It's a case that evokes memories of another earlier shipwreck, as Megan Williams reports. And I do want to issue a warning here, because this report contains a recording at the beginning that some people may find distressing.
Sir?
Hello.
Sir, hello.
Yes. I called Malta. They said that we are near to Lampedusa, more than Malta. I give position.
Yeah.
You have the proximity for us.
One of the desperate calls to the Italian Coast Guard from Mohamed Jamo, a Syrian doctor, made from a sinking boat crammed with more than 400 people in the waters south of Italy.
Yes, you have to call Malta, sir. You have to call Malta.
Those calls, made in 2013, went on for 5 hours, during which time the Italian and Maltese authorities had a standoff and did nothing.
The migrants are, the boat has sank.
Okay, but is it
the
same boat?
It's capsizing, the people are in the water.
More than 260 people, including 60 children, drowned. Two of those children were Mohamed Jamo's, a 5-year-old and a 9-month-old. Survivors of that shipwreck launched a criminal case against Malta and Italy, but it faced multiple obstacles. By the time the case reached the courtroom, the statute of limitations had expired. A United Nations tribunal, though, found both countries' coast guards equally responsible for the deaths.
Yeah, so there was this important statement by the tribunal in which there is a recognition of responsibility, but in the end, no one was sentenced for it.
Italian lawyer Francesca Cancellaro is part of a fresh legal effort to hold Italy's coast guard accountable, this time for a shipwreck that happened just months ago. In early September, also off the coast of Italy. A migrant boat in distress was spotted by a monitoring plane of the rescue NGO Sea-Watch. They alerted Italian authorities, who for 2 days did nothing.
It was clear for everyone since the beginning that these people were facing a shipwreck, but no one intervened, and 21 persons died.
One of the 21 who died was the father of Syrian Ibrahim Hisyan. He, along with 3 survivors and the NGO Sea-Watch, have filed a criminal complaint for multiple manslaughter. The authorities had so many chances to do the right thing, and they didn't, he said. Spokesperson for Sea-Watch, Giorgia Rinaldi, says there's a clear trend of rescues in the Mediterranean taking longer and longer. That's after a 2017 deal Italy struck with Libya, where most boats leave from. In Libya, they face being held hostage by traffickers, with widespread reports of extortion, forced labor, and torture. In the deal between Italy and Libya, Italy funds the North African country's coast guard, run by militias, to push back migrant boats.
Since then, the cooperation between the NGOs and the Italian coast guard has diminished. We used to have a very close cooperation with the Italian coast guard, and now here the blame is not on the Italian coast guard, but on the policies that has led to less collaboration, sharing of information with NGOs. And this has come with a smear campaign against NGOs.
Armed with video, photographs, and survivor testimony, Sea-Watch is hoping to move fast enough with this case to avoid running into the statute of limitations. They're hoping the case will shed light on how high up the command not to rescue the migrants went.
Duty to rescue falls on every captain, regardless of which boat, every person that is informed about a situation of distress. And the exceptions to these duties are only if intervening would put in danger your crew and vessels. There are no other reasons justifying a non-intervention.
Lawyer Francesca Cancellaro says the case also sends an important message to authorities who consider turning their back on their duty.
This legal action could stop the negligence of national authorities and avoid other situations like this one and the deaths of all these people.
By determining who is giving the orders not to rescue and holding them criminally responsible, the kind of accountability that was missing back in 2013.
We are dying, please. Okay, you are.
We are dying.
Yes, you
person.
Are. You have dying. Called Malta. You have called Malta.
Without captain.
Despite desperate calls for hours for help that came too late for almost 300 people. Megan Williams, DW, Rome.
Yes, yes, yes. Call Malta, call Malta. I have not enough account
on the mobile. DW is a member of InfoMigrants, a media collaboration which aims to supply migrants with reliable and verified information at every stage of their journey to and in Europe. The web address for that is infomigrants.net. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe.
Thank you.
still on a justice theme now, but with something a little bit different. And it begins with a question. What happens when the criminal justice system fails? In Norway, several high-profile wrongful convictions have rocked people's trust in the courts, the police and the media. Our Norwegian-born reporter, Lars Bevanger, took a closer look at one case in particular.
In May 2000, Norway was rocked by a crime that would haunt the nation for decades to come. Two girls, 8-year-old Stine Sofia Østergaard Sørstrønen and 10-year-old Lena Slørgedal Paulsen, went missing after going swimming in the Barneheia woods outside the southern city of Kristiansand.
Vi fikk melding om at to døde jenter funnet I Barneheia I Kristiansand.
2 days later, and the entire country was following the search for the girls. That evening, police held a press conference. The girls had been found, raped and murdered, not far from where they'd been swimming.
Viggo Kristiansen, dømt til 21 års fengsel for drapen I Baneheia, Jan Helge Andersen...
Two local men were found guilty of the crime. 19-year-old Jan Helge Andersen and 21-year-old Viggo Kristiansen. They were sentenced to 19 and 21 years in prison, respectively. Kristiansen was also sentenced to preventative detention, meaning his stay in prison could be extended in perpetuity if he is still considered dangerous. Andersen confessed. His sentence was reduced because he claimed Kristiansen had forced him to commit one of the murders. Kristiansen maintained his innocence.
My name is Hege Ulstein, and I'm a former political commentator, and I'm also a writer. Until July 22, 2011, Viggo Kristiansen was the most hated man in Norway. July 22, 2011 was when we had the terrorist attack on Utøya and on Oslo.
Hege Ulstein was one of very few journalists who began to question Viggo Kristiansen's guilt when, in 2010, one of his lawyers tried reopening the case with evidence indicated that he could not have been at the crime scene. The lawyer tried to get the media interested in what he believed could be the greatest miscarriage of justice in Norwegian legal history.
He is met with, this is closed. They have been convicted in two instances. We're finished. That was a big mistake. None of us really looked into it at that point. And if he had done it, I think he would be acquitted around that time, maybe around 2012. And instead he sat for another 10 years as an innocent man in prison.
There was no physical evidence linking Viggo Kristiansen to the crime scene. His conviction rested on the testimony of his former friend, Jan Helge Andersen. Kristiansen's lawyer presented mobile phone data showing he could not have been at the scene. But by now, Kristiansen was well established as a monster in pretty much the entire nation's imagination.
People wouldn't actually discuss the evidence, you know, it says alone.
Jan Olav Jahr has written two books about the Barneheia murders. By 2017, he too was convinced of Viggo Kristiansen's innocence.
I think that the journalists were not very curious, and they didn't investigate why I meant he was innocent. People, what they hear from the first time is often the thing, you know, you keep that. You heard that one guy is a very bad guy, you stick to that. He was in jail for 20 years. You know, it's probably more difficult to say that, oh, we did wrong. So it's better to say, no, we did everything right.
Og vi skal lese opp dommen I Barneheia-saken.
At least three other serious miscarriages of justice have come to light in the past few decades in Norway. So is there something inherently wrong with the system? I asked criminal defence lawyer Bjarne Risnes.
Yes, there is something inherently wrong, as it is in every justice system. Both prosecutors and defence lawyers and judges in the end are just human beings and they make mistakes. If there is a result that everybody wants, it must be this guy, or it has to have happened this way, or because that would ease the pain for a lot of people, including the system itself, then there is a danger that one might jump to conclusions. And what we see in two of the three cases that has been sort of famously reported about over the last few years, and that there were numerous warning signs. I mean, there was red all the way, but they just didn't see them.
Crime itself, which is, as you say, so horrendous and so impossible.
The Barnahea case represented an unimaginable nightmare for any parent, and the desire to catch a perpetrator was keenly felt by thousands of people. Journalist and writer Hege Ulstein believes concern for the bereaved played an important role for those who refused to take a second look at the lack of evidence against Viggo Kristiansen.
In a case like this, there is naturally a lot of concern for the parents, the relatives, the left behinds. How much of a role do you think that might have played in the media's unwillingness to touch this case again?
I think that has played a very big role, and understandably so. They had experienced something that the rest of us were not able to imagine. But I think that maybe some of us should have been a little bit more square and said that, well, we can hear you, but we have to look into this anyway, even if it hurts you to get the case open again.
Her går Viggo Kristiansen rett til skogs etter at riksadvokaten har bedt om at han frifinnes I Baneheia-saken.
Viggo Kristiansen had his case reopened on his sixth attempt and was exonerated in 2022. Jan Helge Andersen was retried and found guilty of both murders earlier this year. He has appealed. Criminal lawyer Brynolf Riesnes hopes the system, the media and the police have learned from this and other stories, but he is far from sure.
History shows that we do not learn. This is a part of being human. We are appalled by a crime, or we have some personal connection to the issue at hand, and we get biased. There's been a lot of research on the ability of different groups of people to tell if someone is telling the truth. And the only sure conclusion is that you can never tell. I think the best thing we can do is to try to understand that we do not understand and put ourselves aside and just carry on analyzing the facts.
Lars Bevanger, DW, Oslo.
I thought I'd end this justice special with two quotes. The first is from a former British Prime Minister, William Gladstone. Justice delayed is justice denied. The second is from an Indian independence leader and peace activist, Mahatma Gandhi. There is a higher court than courts of justice, and that is the court of conscience. It supersedes all other courts. And I love that of the two, it was Gandhi that was the practicing lawyer. Gladstone did train, but never qualified. That's it for today. This programme was produced by me, Kate Laycock, with help from Nick Martin and Benita van Eysen. Our sound engineers were Jürgen Kuhn and Michael Springer, assisted by Yusuf Dudayev. Our feedback address for emails, which we do check and we do really enjoy reading, is insideeurope@dw.com. You can, of course, also comment via the various podcast feeds and, likes, shares and recommendations are also always very much appreciated. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.